hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
We spend so much time discussing the presidential election, but every year there are thousands of other races on the ballot, including for judge. 39 states elect at least some of their judges. These elections generate a ton of campaign spending, especially in recent years. The amount of money in campaigns for judicial races has skyrocketed. Here to discuss the implications of that increase in judicial campaign spending are Joanna Shepherd and Michael Kang, two law professors who recently published a book titled Free to Judge: The Power of Campaign Money in Judicial Elections. Michael is a law professor at Northwestern University, and Joanna is a law professor at Emory University. Michael and Joanna, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so you begin the book with the story of the Iowa judicial elections after a ruling that recognized a right to same-sex marriage under the Iowa Constitution. That's before the U.S. Supreme Court issued its opinions on the issue. Tell us what happened after that decision in Iowa to the judges on the Iowa Supreme Court.
We begin the book with the story of Marcia Ternus, who is a justice on the Iowa Supreme Court. They had decided the year before, in 2009, a case called Varnum versus Bryant, which found that the state could not deny marriage rights to same-sex couples under the state constitution. Now, the justices on the Supreme Court, the Iowa Supreme Court, unanimously agreed that equal protection demanded that same-sex couples have a right to marry. They thought the case was relatively uncontroversial. They followed the federal law model on this. And ultimately, their decision was vindicated by the U.S. Supreme Court. But this upset a lot of conservative groups and conservative interests, including some from out of state. This led to $1 million, basically an unprecedented opposition campaign against the justices that were on the ballot in 2010. And Marcia Ternus, who had run twice for retention, faced really no opposition. I think almost all the retention elections, the justices running for retention had received over 70%. But in this election, these justices, including Marcia Ternus, were defeated. It was a kind of watershed moment in an Iowa Supreme Court history. It was the first time sitting justices had been thrown out. And it marked a kind of change that's been occurring all across the country, where big money campaigns have emerged and arrived for state Supreme Court elections and indicate that judging is different in the current era of big money and politicized elections.
You know, that Iowa election, I remember it well in terms of the retention, and actually show my students one of the ads. I don't want to give away the punchline here, but I encourage listeners to look up the ad of a couple who is thanking the Iowa Supreme Court for blessing their marriage. You probably have seen this ad as well, and it's pretty shocking, but it obviously made a big difference, so much outside money. You know, that's anecdotal, though, and I think many of us assume that money makes a big difference in who wins and their ultimate decision-making on the bench. But you offer in the book an empirical analysis. You look at the actual numbers. So what do the numbers tell us?
As you know, we have done this sort of research for over a decade at this point. And in a lot of our prior studies, we've made the point that money is able to impact judges and their decision-making in a few different ways. One, as you mentioned, is money is used to win elections, so it can affect which candidates actually win and who is on the bench in the first place. And then the second possible pathway through which money can affect the ultimate decision-making of judges is by judges who are kind of thinking about their next re-election. The fact that in 3, 2, 4, however many years, they're going to have to run again. They're going to have to raise campaign funds again. And so they may actually decide cases differently than they otherwise would because of their need to raise this campaign money in the future. In the past, you know, we've noted both of these ways. We've always thought that the second way, the second pathway, is a little bit worse. For the, you know, the main reason is that everybody enters the bench, or really any job they have, with the perspectives they bring from their prior experiences and their background. And so maybe a judge had been a prosecutor and that affects their thinking. Similarly, you know, if they were ideologically conservative or liberal, that could affect their thinking. And so it's not that surprising that if, just to pick on conservative money for a second, conservative money gets conservative benches on the gets conservative judges on the bench, then those judges are then going to vote conservatively. Like, that's not that surprising. It seems much worse if judges are deciding cases differently from how they otherwise would because they're thinking about the need to raise campaign money in the future. So what we did in this study to try to disentangle these two pathways is we looked at a subset of judges. So in 32 states, judges have a mandatory retirement age, a time when they know they can no longer run again. And therefore, in those 32 states, judges know when they're in their last term, when they're no longer going to have to run for re-election, they're no longer going to have to raise campaign money in order to run in that re-election. And so what we do is basically through kind of a complicated regression analysis that I won't bore the listeners with, we you know, include a lot of data on over 650 states, state Supreme Court justices, over 3,000 cases decided over a three-year period. And we can really kind of differentiate those judges that are in their last period, and they know it's their last period, versus all the other judges. And what we find is that the relationship, we specifically are looking at the way the judges vote in cases involving business interests. And we are looking at the relationship between their voting in those cases and the money that they have received from pro-business groups. We're not necessarily trying to pick on business money or anything. It just so happens that there's a lot of business money and there's a lot of business cases. So it's a it's an area where we're likely to pick up an empirical relationship. And what we find is that when judges are in their last term and they're no longer going to have to raise campaign contributions, the relationship between the money and their pro-business votes is significantly diminished. It seems like, you know, there's still some relationship because, again, there's probably more pro-business money going towards more conservative judges, and those judges vote conservatively because that's kind of true to their ideological perspective. But there's a much weaker relationship between the money and the voting than there is in the other periods when the judges are forward thinking and they have to think about raising money for their future elections.
So it's really about knowing you have to run for election again. You are going to rule a particular way because you need that campaign money, or you want it at least, for your next election. Did that finding about the closeness of the tie between the amount of business spending and judges' votes surprise you? I'm going to pull out a quote from the early chapter of your book where you write, "Roughly speaking, averaged over all judges, each $10,000 contribution from a business increases the odds of a judge casting a pro-business vote by about 1%. That seems pretty stark. Did that number surprise you to how close you saw? And, you know, there's a chart there that shows, you know, okay, if you have multiple 10,000 contributions, then the likelihood of a pro-business vote gets even higher. What did you make of that, those numbers?
Yeah, it wasn't that surprising to us because, again, Michael and I have performed, you know, a dozen of these studies at this point, and we're not always looking at pro-business money. We've looked at money from other interest groups as well, and we typically find this relationship. Just to throw out a few, you know, money from interest groups supporting kind of limited medical malpractice, we'll see a relationship in those kinds of cases. Again, a lot of times we look at business money just because there's a lot of it and there's a lot of business cases, but we have found this relationship in other studies as well, where we're looking at different kinds of money in different kinds of cases. So we weren't surprised that the relationship existed. In terms of the magnitude of the relationship, you know, I think it's I don't think, I mean, Michael can, you know, speak for himself on this. I personally wasn't surprised. The average amount of money from pro-business groups that is raised in these elections is about $170,000. And so, you know, for somebody who's, you know, the difference between raising no pro-business money and the average pro-business money would be about a 17% increase. Again, this is on average. This is not every judge by any means. You know, that, to me, that seems large enough to be something we should pay attention to, but not so large that it feels unbelievable.
And how much has this changed over the past decade or so? Is it really been a stark increase the amount of money in judicial campaigns and the effect of that money?
I think the relationship between campaign money and judicial decision making, as Joanna said, it's a pretty robust relationship. We find that with all different kinds of contributors. We found that for different eras before and after Citizens United. So I don't think the basic predictive relationship between campaign contributions received and decisions that are favorable to the interests of the contributors, that I don't think that's new. It might be increasing a little bit, but I don't think the basic pattern is different. I do think the role of money in judicial elections is increasing overall. There's a few different reasons for that. I think some of them are legal. There was a Supreme Court case that essentially opened up judicial campaigning in the early 2000s. And I think that increased the intensity and the political quality of state Supreme Court races. Citizens United, a big campaign finance case that Josh, you and I teach every year, really opened up a bigger space for unregulated independent expenditures and for corporate money. So I think that really freed up space for money to play a role in elections. I think probably the bigger change is hyper-partisanship overall in the American political system, which has made every race, every competitive race really important and has put partisan kind of energy behind all the available and important races. And increasingly, I think political decision makers think of state Supreme Court seats as politically meaningful and important. There's a big return on investment there because by changing a couple state Supreme Court races, you can really change the policy in a state. It's a lot harder to do that in the state legislature where you've got to win lots of seats and flip the majority in the legislature. State Supreme Court races, I think despite the fact that the money's gone up, are still relatively cheap for what you're getting if you're able to change the result. And we talk about one race in particular in West Virginia where spending $3 million really was very meaningful for that campaign contributor who ended up changing a $50 million verdict against his company and flipping the kind of political composition of the state Supreme Court in the process. So I think it's a combination of things. Some are legal, but a lot of which are political and reflect larger macro changes in American politics.
So, and some of those changes in terms of the partisanship of the courts, we've seen these flips, right? The North Carolina Supreme Court flipped in its partisanship and changed decisions, including on partisan gerrymandering as a result. The Wisconsin Supreme Court kind of flipped the other way, right? How hard is it now for states that want to run nonpartisan judicial elections to do so, right? If the state says we're committed to not having party labels on the ballot, does this money make that kind of impossible now?
The money makes it much more difficult, certainly, because even if a state is running a nonpartisan ballot, which means that on the ballot, the candidates are listed without party labels next to their names, if you have a lot of money, they're typically running TV ads, social media ads, and they will make it very clear what the political affiliation of the candidates is, even if these states are trying to run nonpartisan ballots. And so I do think that the amount of money and the way that it's being spent, and as Michael said, the purpose for which it's being spent, really kind of, you know, politicizing the courts, is making it much more difficult for the candidates and the states overall to run nonpartisan elections.
So Michael mentioned the West Virginia case where, you know, an individual spent a whole lot of money on a judicial race for West Virginia Supreme Court, got the case overturned, the jury verdict against him in a civil case. That case, although, went to the U.S. Supreme Court, right? And the Supreme Court said, you know, that donation was so close that the judge who benefited should have recused. So is that a good enough solution, right? If you are going to be, if you're a judge and you have a case before you, you know, you should recuse if the it looks like that money might influence you? Or do you have a better solution, as you discuss in the book?
Yeah, I don't think that we're opposed to judicial recusal as at least a partial remedy to campaign finance spending in state Supreme Court races. You're right. In the West Virginia case, Caperton versus Massey, the court ordered the judge to recuse in a case involving essentially someone who had spent a lot of money to get him on the bench. I think Chief Justice Roberts, in his dissent in that case, raised a lot of questions, which are, how do we apply that rule? You know, how much money does it depend on what the proportion of money given in that case, in that election, is relative to the total amount spent? He asked a ton of questions that are important questions. They might have answers, and we think we had some answers in the book, but it is not necessarily an easy rule to apply. And what I found when we looked at the what had happened in the states after Caperton was that largely the states didn't do a lot in reaction to Caperton. So I don't think that that's really become a policy solution or a reform that addresses the role of money in state Supreme Court elections. What we suggest in the book is that re-election really matters in terms of mediating the relationship between money and decision-making in favor of contributors. And what we argue is that getting rid of re-elections for judges will address a lot of the problem. And so I think we're comfortable with lots of different solutions, like lifetime appointment would be a way of getting rid of judicial re-election, but itself raises lots of problems. We have a basic issue that judicial elections are themselves really popular and probably not going away. No state has really done away with judicial elections in a very long time. And if anything, there's kind of a trend toward judicial elections. And so what we argue in the book is that we can keep judicial elections because it's really re-elections that addresses a lot of the problem, but have state Supreme Court justices elected to a single long term. Let them be there for a reasonable amount of time so that they become good at their jobs and we benefit from their expertise on the job. We don't necessarily want to change the nature of the job or the average time spent on the bench, but we want to get rid of this temptation of re-election that kind of sits in the background for these justices and biases their decision making. So we suggest a single term limit of 14 years. You get elected, you serve 14 years, and then after that 14 years, you're out. So it's essentially like our lame duck judges. When you're elected, you know you don't have to face re-election. You don't have to raise money. And hopefully that means that you are not going to be affected by the need to raise money and bias your decision-making in favor of your contributors. What we found in the book is that the lame ducks are still kind of affected by selection. Conservative judges that are supported by conservative money still decide cases conservatively because they're conservative. But what we find is that the effect of money, the additional effect of money, the biasing effect goes away. And they really don't display the same sort of bias that other judges that do face re-election exhibit. And so what we want to do is make all judges like that, where they're not affected by this re-election temptation to favor their contributors and bias where they stand on cases.
Would they be barred from any future election for any office? I mean, because I could imagine a situation where you're a judge for 14 years and you want to go to the next higher court or you want to run for some other office. And so those donations still might make a difference for your next campaign.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think for state Supreme Court justices, there's really not a higher judicial office. It is true. Occasionally you see state Supreme Court justices run for other offices like attorney general or governor, for instance, in Texas. But it's not that common. It's not a great stepping stone in most states for higher office. I have faced, we get some questions about whether there's other sorts of temptations that if you were term limited, would you then, you know, set yourself up for the next job? And that's harder to predict. It's certainly not as systematic as what we're seeing here. And I think that falls into the category of the sorts of incentives that every person kind of has, that you might want to set yourself up for the next job, but there wouldn't be as pervasive and systematic as this kind of re-election temptation that we have in our current system. What we tried to do is set up a system where the incentives, the kind of post-state Supreme Court incentives, are not that different than where state Supreme Court justices would be without re-election currently. So that is, most state Supreme Court justices are elected kind of later in their career because you need to establish yourself as a credible lawyer to be able to run for state Supreme Court. So it's a little different than legislative office sometimes, where there's not a similar kind of professional record you have to accrue. And then with an average career currently of something like 12 to 14 years, we're trying to mimic that with the term limit. So we think that under our proposal of a 14-year single term limit, justices will probably start their careers on the state Supreme Court and end their careers around the same time. And it tends to be that this job, the state Supreme Court justice, is a career capper. So it's kind of the last significant job that most of these lawyers have. And after that, they might work in arbitration or something like that, but they're typically not leapfrogging to another office.
Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time here. So we're almost out of time. And let me just get one more question in before we are. Which is, this sounds like money runs everything in judicial elections. So why should people vote in the first place?
Well, people should vote for exactly that reason, because if they don't vote, then the money really is running everything. And, you know, not only should people vote, but it would be ideal if people were educated about the candidates while they were voting, because right now, the way a lot of people, the only reason they've heard of a candidate is because big money has run big ads about particular candidates they especially like or especially don't like. That kind of sticks in someone's brain when they're going to vote, and that's who they vote for or against. But a lot of times the information that voters have, if they're not seeking it on their own, is determined by the big money in the first place. And so, you know, it's not only important for people to vote, but to be educated about the candidates that they're voting for to make sure they're not just being influenced unduly by the money interests.
Michael Kang and Joanna Shepherd are law professors and the author of Free to Judge, The Power of Campaign Money in Judicial Elections. Michael and Joanna, thanks so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Josh, judges running for election and re-election, has it always been this way?
Not quite. Back in 1776, when America was founded, all states selected their judges through either gubernatorial or legislative appointments. That lasted until 1832, when Mississippi became the first state to implement judicial elections. Other states began to follow suit, and by the start of the Civil War, 24 of the 34 states had an elected judiciary. But not all judicial elections are the same. In fact, there are four different kinds of elections for judges. First, there are the familiar partisan elections. Candidates appear on the ballot alongside their designated political party affiliation. Second, there are nonpartisan elections, which, in contrast, strip away party labels from the ballot, aiming to focus voters' attention solely on the qualifications and merits of the candidates rather than their political affiliations. Third, there are retention elections, where voters decide whether incumbent judges should remain in office for another term, providing a periodic check on judicial performance without the need for incumbents to launch full campaigns each election cycle. Of course, this method only applies when there is an incumbent. For initial terms, another election method must be used. Finally, there's the Michigan method. Yes, Michigan has its own way to elect judges. It involves a blend of both partisan and nonpartisan elements. The political parties hold nominating conventions to select candidates, but the candidates run in the general election without partisan labels. While the vast majority of states hold judicial elections at the state or local level, a handful of states, mostly in New England, appoint their judges. In those states, either a nominating commission selects candidates to submit to the governor, for the governor to then choose someone from the list, or the governor or legislature simply makes the choice without a commission.
Josh, anybody who's been on I-64 at the Mount Sterling, Kentucky exit during the third weekend of October must have noticed the long line of traffic at the exit ramp. How does an annual traffic backup relate to judges?
Yeah, this is really interesting. It's because of Kentucky's oldest running festival known as Court Days. It began in 1794, when people convened in Mount Sterling, Kentucky, to buy, sell, and barter goods and services each time the circuit judge came to town. They did so to put alleged criminals on trial. Court Day was the one time each year people from all over the region had reason to travel into town. It became a cornerstone of social life at the time. Beyond the transactional side of things, there were also athletic competitions and political speeches. This was the premier time and place for politicians to reach a live regional audience. The festival today spans 4 days and is a major shopping event in central Kentucky. It still attracts its fair share of politicians, especially before voting begins in November, but I don't think people are still coming to town just because the circuit judge is there.
What's one thing we can do, Josh, to support democracy?
I always think it's a good idea to become more educated on who represents you and who will be on your ballot. So take a few minutes to search online to learn about your local judges. For state Supreme Courts, you can visit a Bolt magazine resource titled Your State-by-State Guide to Every State Supreme Court.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU. I'm gonna read them my books, I'm gonna wrap them up tight. I can educate myself on the fight.